Thank you, Monica. So it is March 3rd, 2026. And you can look up in your history books what's going on today. We are going to start with a period of meditation, which I will partially guide and partially leave to quiet. You'll have to guess which part is which. Hopefully, you won't have to guess. That should be evident. Excuse me. All right. So we begin by just arranging the body, settling the body. And you can sit, you can lie down, you can stand, you can walk. These are the four traditional postures. And I suppose there are others, but these are the main ones that the Buddha suggested we could be mindful in. So if you're sitting or lying down, you might close your eyes or just lower your gaze. Turning the attention inward. Turning the attention first to just the experience of the body, feeling how you're holding the body, the balance, alignment. What sensations are present? And then more subtly, what energies might be moving through the body, pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. So our mind state is often reflected in the body, just as the mind state is affected by the body, the interaction of the two. And then letting the body settle, having a sense of releasing any tension and of holding tightness. And here we can use the breath. As we exhale, we release. As we inhale, we open. Opening, releasing, releasing, opening. And feeling the movement of breath and the sensations of breath. This connection between the breath and the whole body, the breath and the mind, the breath and the nervous system. And so we're putting the attention on this sense level, the touch of breath, energies in the body. But it's quite natural that thoughts carry us away from this more primal level of experience. When you notice thinking happening, just acknowledging that first, recognizing that the attention is and captured by the verbal realm of mind. And then letting go of that, coming back to the body, to the breath, to the energetic experience. And letting that moment of return be a moment of letting go through the body. Letting go energetically. So stress, anxiety, tension, grasping, all this is softened, released. Letting go of the thought world and entering into this sensed world, felt world, isn't always comfortable. There can be a resistance to it, or a fear of feeling the raw experience of existence. The vulnerability, being alive. And so we breathe with this as well, if this obstruction is here. Can we let go of fear, of aversion, of resistance? Just let things be as they are. Be present for them as they are. This is not to suggest that we push ourselves into unsafe mental or energetic spaces. If there is a sense of losing control, of powerful resistance, we can step back, open the eyes. Just listen to sound or feel the breath just moving. Not trying to probe deeper than that. Just be aware that you are here. It's enough. There's no achievement in meditation. No winning or losing. It's just being here. Whatever that means, however that manifests for you. A good word sometimes to drop into the mind is ease, to bring ease to this moment, to your relationship to this moment. The art of meditation involves intuiting when to just allow and let go, when to bring more intentionality or effort into our practice. By just letting feelings and thoughts flow through? Or do I want to step in and do something more active, like counting the breaths or noting thoughts? Or just simply pointing the attention more directly to the experience of breath? At times we need that kind of active inner guidance or effort, and other times we find it actually intruding on the experience. Or it's better to just sit back and allow things to come and go. There isn't one right way to approach this. This is why we are responsible for our own practice. Have to make those choices moment by moment. It's not, again, a matter of doing it right or making the right choice. It's cultivating a subtle awareness. That can help you to make those choices and then to evaluate the results of the effort or lack of effort. Okay. So I thought I'd talk maybe for a few minutes about how I view the role of meditation in recovery. In the 12 steps, step 11 says we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, which right away is not like why I meditate. Since I don't believe in God, at least not in the sense of what that sounds like it's talking about. And so I like to shorten that to sought to improve my conscious contact with reality, with the present moment. And then it goes on to talk about guidance and to know that with the will of God. And again, not something that resonates for me in my belief system, but I can stretch it to kind of mean, okay, I'm trying to like get more clarity about like wise choices or something like that. But all of that seems to be sort of unnecessary if I just step out of that model altogether and sort of just think about meditation. What is it? And I will say that I think that, I think I could be wrong, but I think that most people come to meditation with very little idea of how it really works or what it's for. I know I came to it with this sort of magical thinking. And we can sort of have these vague ideas of some mystical experience or maybe something practical experience like, oh, it's going to take care of my stress or something, which is all good and useful. And even mystical experiences are lovely. One way to kind of start with understanding the role of meditation in recovery, this is how I would present it when I would go into treatment centers and I was trying to kind of give them a quick like motivation to do this. Say, well, mindfulness meditation can give you two things. It can give you some calm that will help you to have less stress, which is really helpful when you're an addict, and because addicts tend to, take on a lot of stress or to carry a lot of stress. And it can give you some sort of understanding of your own mind because you're starting to see your thoughts and see the things that go on in your mind. So the calm and the inner understanding and these correlate to the traditional aspects of Buddhist meditation, which are concentration and insight. Where I think this then needs to be expanded, let's say, is the term insight. And this is, again, I think a term that's much misunderstood. I often refer to the title of Joseph Goldstein's first book. And if you don't know who Joseph Goldstein is, I recommend that you look him up and you read some of his books. He's one of the founders of the Western Buddhist insight tradition, let's say, and just kind of a brilliant teacher and very wise elder, although not that much more elderly than me, but more elderly in the in wisdom than I. His first book was titled The Experience of Insight. Now, in the English language, as I understand it, I'm not an expert, but I was an English major, so I can make some guesses that insight typically refers to a thought, something that I came to understand intellectually or cognitively. A flash of insight. Oh, I figured it out, So the idea of insight as an experience doesn't really make sense in English. It makes sense In Pali, the language of the early Buddhist teachings, because the insight is a translation of the word vipassana, which means literally to see clearly. So when we talk about to see clearly, we can see we're, it doesn't mean to think clearly. To see clearly, actually another metaphor, it's not literally visual, right? It's an understanding that's, let's start by saying that it's nonverbal, at least initially. And it is something that we experience, that we understand something we've experienced. We all experience the Dharma in our lives, inevitably, because it's the Dharma is just the truth of reality, impermanence, suffering, the causes of suffering, all, clinging, all these things. We experience, everybody experiences this stuff. Most people don't understand or see what's happening. And so insight helps us to see and understand our experience, put it together, start to see the interconnections, the causal relationships between things like thoughts and feelings, feelings and thoughts, wanting and suffering, anger and pain, love and freedom, letting go. And so this practice is meant to, and part of what it's meant to do is help us to understand our experience of life, and thus to see how we create suffering and see how we can end suffering. So by watching, watching, again, a visual metaphor, watching our experience, watching what happens when I'm trying to pay attention to my breath and my mind wanders, what happens in that moment. Okay, this is really key. What happens in that moment, if you pay attention to what you're feeling, is that there is some kind of discomfort or inner agitation, because your thought, virtually every thought we have, is a thought of craving, of wanting, of resisting, of controlling. It's something that's about not wanting things to be the way they are, wanting things to be different, or wanting to be somewhere else, or to be someone else. So most of our thoughts are thoughts that are in resistance to reality. And when we see that, and we see that what happened, what that feels like to resist reality, we see that resisting reality is a losing proposition. And so we are inspired to stop doing that, which is the simple process of coming back to the breath, because the breath is always real when we experience it. And it's a simple thing. It's not, you could come back to many things that are real, just how you're feeling is real. Your thoughts are also real, but it's hard to pay attention to thoughts objectively, because we are so identified with the thoughts that appear in our minds. We could, if we could be, theoretically, thought can be an object of mindfulness, but we have such an inclination, such a tendency to identify with thoughts as I, me, mine, that it's very difficult for us to have the stance that mindfulness requires, which is an objective stance, we could say a watchful stance. It's very difficult to watch thoughts. can happen. You can do it when you're very, but you have to be very concentrated, which anyway, long story. So now I want to go a little bit deeper into this in terms of connecting to this to recovery. Because where I go and where I think the core of our struggle as addicts is, we could say it's emotional, but even more, I prefer to even get out of that kind of language and talk more about it as energetic, that the feelings that move through our bodies, that manifest as mental states, that these are hard for us to hold. And are these mental states trigger some of those things, but sometimes those energies just arise on their own life. You can be in a state, be having a feeling that got triggered by something that happened 2 days ago and not realize that's why you're carrying that within you. And knowing that it's something that happened 2 days ago doesn't really solve it. It still requires that you learn in this moment to be with this feeling, to breathe with this feeling, and to give it enough space so that it can exist and then cease to exist. What we often do with unpleasant feelings is we don't give them the space to cease to exist. We keep rather interacting with them. And that interaction in and of itself feeds them. The classic phrase, what we resist persists, fits into this, description. So whether we're resisting it, trying to fix it, or even praising it, the feeling, as we think about the feeling, it's creating this feedback loop that I talk about so much. Thoughts trigger feelings, feelings trigger thoughts, and the way to interrupt that is to stop the thoughts, if as best you can, and just stay with the feelings. Now, the problem with that for many of us, I'd say, is that we're not comfortable having the feelings we're talking about are unpleasant. And so there's a reason why we were thinking about them, trying to fix them and trying going to the therapist to try to work them out because they're unpleasant. We want to get rid of them. Natural instinct. However, we can't just make feelings go away. Rather, I mean, there's other strategies, I suppose, but one strategy is to just let them be because of the inevitability of impermanence. They will pass. And if we can hold them with love, with care, with self-compassion, without reactivity, without trying to fix, without trying to analyze, then we breathe with them, they come, they go, and they pass on. So this is, for me, the deeper purpose of meditation, and this is it really this kind of process that I'm describing requires both the insight of watching carefully and the concentration that allows us to sustain that watching long enough to allow the feeling to transform. And this is where I think the healing really happens in recovery through meditation, on this visceral level, on this level of learning to hold and be with the difficult feelings that for me, at 40 years sober, thank you, I still got my chip in my hand, should still show up. I think it's I've heard people in AA meetings say that once they got sober and worked the steps, they didn't have any difficult feelings anymore, I guess. That's not me, I will say. Life goes on. This is kind of a post-retreat kind of a talk, because it's kind of carrying on some of the spaces that we were investigating on the retreat, particularly on, I guess, Saturday morning was the guided meditation that felt like it went pretty deep for me. I hope that people who don't have, as you know, haven't recently experienced 5 days of noble silence, are not confused or whatever, you know, by this exploration. That's actually all I have to get the conversation started. So we have plenty of time left for thoughts and comments. Happy to hear from anybody who wants to jump in. Yeah, John.
This is a great topic for me because, over the course of spending these Tuesdays with you and a retreat, last year, the idea, I've come to realize how entrenched the idea of God is in my experience. And I was raised a Methodist, which is almost like not having a religion. They're pretty easygoing about everything. But I'm struggling, and it's not much of a struggle, with that very idea of replacing just even the word God with reality. And because it seems so amorphous, compared to what is, archetypal vision of a God. So I don't know. I'm not sure where this is leading me. So I'm just sort of bringing it up as a, the idea of you bringing that topic today was really good to hear. I'll re-listen to this, once you post it up. But I just wanted to sort of acknowledge that I'm in that sort of, I feel like an in-between stage where I'm trying to let go of a childhood vision of, quote, a God, whatever, and what's a more, I think, more mature view of the world, frankly.
Yeah, I guess I a excuse me. Another thing, word you could replace God with is Dharma. Turn your will and your life over to the care of the Dharma. And that, of course, then it means you need to study the Dharma, figure out what that means. But it also gives you something pretty specific. You know, if you say, you know, that primarily that means the Eightfold Path, then that means, you know, committing to living ethically, morally, cultivating, you know, wholesome mind state through meditation, and trying to view the world through the lens of Dharma, through the lens of truth, remembering impermanence, remembering how clinging causes suffering, the Four Noble Truths, and cultivating loving kindness. You know, turn your will and your life over to the care of love. It's one of my favorites. Very powerful to think about that. Humbly asked love to remove our shortcomings. I mean, you know, that can do a lot of work for you right there. I think, yeah, if you're going to work with the 12 steps, and you're not, and I don't like the term atheist, because I view it as kind of too solid. I don't believe in God. I do believe in God. I'm not really interested in in belief. I'm interested in what is real. But anyway, you know, you might try some different language like that, rather than just reality. And of course, I always recommend my book, Burning Desire, now called Buddhism, the 12 Steps, Higher Power, as a way to explore this topic, which I did in that book. Yeah. Thanks, John.
Great,
Yeah.
great, thanks.
And yeah, I guess I am a little bit behind. Doug said something in a private message to me. I guess I hope that doesn't mean I'm not allowed to read it. How about insight as awareness of previously unrecognized relationships? Maybe I shouldn't have read that because I don't know what it means. I'm not sure what previously unrecognized really. I'm not sure if you mean like literal, human relationships or relationships between different factors. Maybe.
What I'm talking about is relationships with sunyata, with the entirety of everything.
Okay, well, sunyata in it means emptiness. So having a relationship, I don't think we can have a relationship with the emptiness. I mean, just it seems to me that emptiness sort of implies non-duality, and so yeah, but.
Well, everything is related with everything else.
Right, sure. Yeah.
And
And
we're
yeah.
only aware of a very few of the relationships that exist. And so what an insight would be doing would becoming aware of other relationships that we previously had not recognized. That was my point.
Right. No, I mean that's yeah. This is, I mean, I made a kind of brief passing reference to this, the idea of the causes, karmic causes and conditions that we start to make these connections, if that's what you're talking about. Yes, we start to see relationships between different types of thought, different types of feelings, different what, expressions of reality. So. Thank you. Liz.
Hi, thank you. I'm going to go back to what you said about feelings and staying with feelings.
Yeah.
Our family is new to recovery. And this past Thanksgiving, we had our first Thanksgiving without our son, who is in a recovery center. And that brought up a lot of feelings. So I got up early that morning to meditate. And it end up being just about 40 minutes of just not crying, you know. I mean, I couldn't, there really weren't thoughts, but it was just weeping. I was just so distressed at what brought him there and him not being here and the separation that we were experiencing as a family. But what that allowed us to do was to move forward with the day. We had family, invited people we love, and we did Thanksgiving. But it was that morning of that 40 minutes alone in meditation. And I don't, it was such a lived experience of something different. It didn't make the feelings go away.
Right.
Not like I worked through anything, but I do believe that that moment, that morning, changed the suffering of the day.
Thanks, Liz. That's beautiful and yes, sad and more than sad. There's a richness to that, which what I hear in that is that when we see the truth of things, while it can be painful, it's not confusing and disruptive. That when we are hiding and repressing, family secrets, for instance, though that repression comes out in destructive ways, and
Wow.
people wind up drinking and backbiting, and there's all kinds of stuff that's happening that's poisonous to a family. Whereas when we all recognize, well, this is really sad, and we are all, it's really hard to see, but there is this reality, and you know, you're crying because you love, there's love there. And so it doesn't fix things, but things, bringing things into the light is the beginning of the healing process. There's no growth or change as long as it's repressed. I mean, this is why denial, you know, keeps us caught in the cycle of addiction.
That's beautiful. Thank you.
Thank
Thank you.
you. Yeah. Flo, thank you for coming out from behind that big, like a stuffed animal you had there in your.
It was from Universal. My husband and I go there for our anniversary, so it's me being a
Okay.
big kid. It's me indulging my inner child.
Yes, go for it.
I would just say what I was thinking is when you were mentioning about the step and then God, it's very interesting. I just celebrated 10 years. There's that.
Yoo-hoo!
Saturday was
Congratulations.
10 years. So
Hey, 30 more and you'll catch one, get one of these.
30 more. We'll see. I hope.
Just kidding.
But it's interesting because I did just go back because I had your old version of a burning desire, and then I did purchase the new one, Higher Power. So I've
It's the
been,
same book, so you don't need both.
I know, but
Sorry.
I wanted to support you and buy it
Well,
again.
thank you. I appreciate it.
But the other is that around, I don't know, I've been struggling, I think, with that, what you were saying, you were rephrasing that step of just conscious contact with reality, I think is what you said, which I thought was really cool. But I was like, I've been struggling with that leading up to the sober birthday. It ebbs and flows. So that's when I got back out your book. I'm like, I'm just going to read the new one from a fresh perspective. And it's just so interesting starting it again because I devoured it the first 3 years of my recovery. But starting it now, it's like I have a little bit of a different perception, and then, well, a lot different perception. But rereading the parts in your book where you talk about it's not how you label God, because I've gone through the atheist, the agnostic, being a Catholic, like I've done all of the things looking, because I was a seeker my whole life, which is one of the reasons why I drink and use. But it's just interesting because it always sticks out to me that it's that you phrase it in your book, it's how you experience God. And that was the first time, and again the second time around reading it, that it's like I don't have to label my higher power. And it's just so refreshing to have that, to be in a room with other sober people that can also have that context, because I'm in the Deep South and it's assumed to be one thing. So I just wanted to say thank you again, because that book is so helpful.
Thanks, Flo. It's nice to see you.
Hello, I'm in Alabama, where we end all 12-step meetings with the Lord's Prayer, as if those are related to one another.
Yeah.
That's how it is here.
Thanks, Michael. Flo is only in Georgia, which really isn't nearly as bad, I gotta say. You've got two Democratic senators. Come on, man. Like,
No,
it's
okay,
not that deep.
I am outside of Atlanta, where it was
Yeah.
not blue.
Right. You know, it's funny what comes up for me around that, odd, and this is not exactly connected to what you're saying, is the same point. It's up the point I want to point to is about not having to label God is also to not have to label our emotions. And you know, I've been sort of having this ongoing conversation with a therapist friend who's very into this idea and concerned about the whole idea of diagnosis and not wanting to people to get diagnosed, that that isn't necessarily the healthiest way to help people. And that for me goes back to deciding when I was 14 that I was depressed, and then how that f feeds the depression. like having an unpleasant feeling that I label as something. And some years ago, not that long ago, some frickin' therapist tried to tell me, "Oh, well, I think you might have bipolar too." And I was like, "You know what? I'm out. Like, I don't need that. It's not helpful." Like, and so God or feelings, a lot of things that we label, it's really important to see that in Buddhist terms, that's called perception. We were talking about it this weekend. It's labeling something, giving it a name based on memory and beliefs that solidifies something rather than something being like, well, what? Well, this is interesting. I'm having an experience, because emotions aren't solid things. They are flowing forms of energy that move through the mind and body. And if you want heart, if whatever language works for you, but when we solidify them verbally, they t that can tend towards solidifying them emotionally and mentally and physically, so that these things get stuck in us because of our belief system. It's very weird. You know, this is the stuff that's like creating your own reality. Like, what you believe, you're feeling, you know, how you identify what you're feeling has a direct influence on the feeling itself and its lifespan. Anyway, I'm a little activated.
Well, doesn't that kind of, I don't know, what came to mind when you were sharing that is it takes it back to right view to me. You know, a lot of
Yes.
this naming, you know, labeling things, it's just kind of selfing. Like
Yes.
I've myself was very hesitant to, you know, agree with my wife's characterization that some of my children are ADHD. You know, just because I used that as a crutch to fuel my addiction until I was in my 30s, you know. I don't know. I'll shut up now.
Well, you know, thank you, Michael, because now you're reminding me, as I try to do, which is, wait a minute, what's the other side of this that I'm missing? Which is that, like, for me, it was really helpful when I diagnosed myself as an alcoholic. You know, it was useful. And so, you know, someone saying, oh, ADHD maybe is helpful, like, oh, that kind of helps me understand why I have these certain types of problems, and I now I can sort of address that in some way. And so it can work both ways, as things do, which is why life is too damn complicated. But yeah, at the same time, it can become this finger pointing and like judgment. And so just really being careful how we use these things, and using them lightly and using them as solutions, not as judgments, right? As pointing toward a solution. Oh, there's this issue. Oh, are there tools that relate to that that might help me to move beyond it, you know? Rather than, oh, I've got this problem, you know, I'm always depressed. That's so depressing. Carolyn, let's finish up with you. You made it back home safely.
Yes, I did. I
This
took.
is we're having sort of a southern moment here. We're
Yeah,
getting
we're in North Carolina.
Georgia, North Carolina, Alabama. I love it.
Yeah. But I was in California a few days ago.
That's true, with the cool people.
I'll try to be speed. I mean, just since I've started doing the meditation with the retreats. Just my mind, just I have problem putting it all together. I admire the words that I hear, and they just sink in so emotionally, like yeah. Trying to figure a way to make it short. Recently, I've shared recently in December. I mean, of course, it's a hard month, but it hit me really hard. It was like I almost thought I was having a nervous breakdown. I wasn't trying, I was keeping it simple, but found my anxiety tendency, which I have shared that. In these workshops and with me, kind of overrid me a little, not in a dangerous way, but in a very, 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 very uncomfortable way. Not dangerous because I've got a lot of sobriety, and through these speaking with you, Kevin, listening to you, recognizing the feeling of the, and you labeled it once for me that my anxiety was because I would experience sitting in meditation for no reason at all that I could figure out. And you just labeled it. It's energy. And I went, oh, and that sunk really good, really nice. But it's still there, still comes. So the my meditating practice is to help me find a sense of calmness. Just all that you've been sharing, the understanding of my own mind. But I cannot do this without having the Sangha. Just like I can't recover, be a happy recovering alcoholic without my AA group. Yes, but I'm fortunate to have a group these days that we don't, nobody likes the word God, but nobody's willing to go beyond that. A few of us. So I'm kind of starting to bring a little insight, you know, best I can to them, but they don't want the Buddhist thinking. So I'm having to filter it, which is good for me. Sometimes I don't say anything. It's not necessary. Just listen. But what I guess I was getting at, how I don't, there's the way my mind and my disappointment and depression, my doc wants to work for me. I couldn't face any of this without the group and the help and knowing that others are having difficulty. And I think the other piece takeaway from the retreat was what understanding really what compassion for myself is. It's different than self-care. I realized that out on one of my walks. It's realizing, you know, I don't get it and I don't have the words for it yet, but it hit me really hard. They're like, it's not what I thought it was. And, you know, it's worth all the anxiety to realize, you know, that we hear the words, I'm not a bad person, be good, kind to yourself. What makes you hear all that? But to experience how my thinking pulls into that emotion, that just, you know, it's just, I've kind of very, I'm experiencing this and it's ongoing, but it needs the feed, that needs the nourishment of the groups and wording. And I did read a few pages of the Higher Power book, and it's like, wow. So I'm getting excited to have some more come in and kind of, for me, it's like, it's sobriety. You don't drink, you can't experience sobriety without putting down the drink. That's when my life began. But I didn't know what that meant because I couldn't put down drink. So I'm lost. This is like, okay, I have these experiences, not like they go away and then I understand. It's like, oh, I have these experiences. That's what I heard the other day. Oh, that's what I just heard now. Oh, and somehow the calmness of the mind is coming from the meditation practice to have whatever is going on inside of me. It's different. So I just want to say thank you. And it's the support of others on this planet.
Well, thank you, Carolyn. And just one thing, I mean, it does seem like the central thing you're touching on is the sangha, is the community, is the fellowship. And I think it's a really good point that self-compassion, we learn it by being with others, by being loved by others, and by hearing other people's experience. And it does, a lot of this stuff, we connect with it without understanding it, and we kind of fall in love with the Dharma without necessarily being able to, explain any of it. It's just like, oh, it's right. It's just right. It just feels right. And that's why we, keep coming back, keep doing this practice, because it feels right. And with time, depending, I mean, everybody has a different sort of way of understanding things. But frankly, I didn't really understand much of the Dharma. I loved it, but I couldn't have explained much of it until I started to teach. So it's not really necessary to be able to, have that kind of verbal understanding as much as it, is to just be in love with it and live it. I see. I'm not sure why, Liz, you're asking will we get a new Zoom link for upcoming weeks. Monica, we're still good with these links, or did you say we had a new one
No,
coming?
I just have I'll talk to you about it later, but no, and
Yeah, you should be able to, Liz, you should be able to use the same link then.
it's the same link, but it's custom designed to you.
Oh, custom designed to you.
Yeah,
So you
so
have to save your
save it
own.
somewhere so
Okay.
you can keep re-signing in from there.
Okay. Right. That explains it. Thank you.
There's a below the what does it say? Enter meeting or there's an actual custom design Zoom link. I throw that in my calendar on my computer
Yeah.
so I don't lose it. Yeah.
So Flo, you pointed out something quite important, because which is full moon, and because it's a full moon and the sun is in Pisces,
Oh.
the full moon is in Virgo, which is the opposite of Pisces. And I know you mentioned last week that you are a Pisces, and so this is like the worst time of the month for Pisces.
Yeah, my birthday was yesterday.
It's the opposite. It's the opposite moon sign. For those of us who still have some kind of lingering, I kind of dropped astrology for a long time, but lately it's sort of been sneaking back. I don't want anybody to think that I believe in astrology in the strict sense of like there's some magic or something, but there are just sort of like these interesting things about the full moon and like the contrasts, the energies that sometimes we sense, or we at least think we're sensing. So, moon eclipse tonight, West Coast. Oh, excellent. Thank you, Liz. All right. On that fine note, I will depart before the golf course gets full. That never happened. All right, folks. Thank you for coming. Blessings.
Thank you.
Thank you,
May
Kevin.
all addicts be free from suffering, and peace. And I'll be back next week.
May you
Thanks,
get two
Kevin.
birdies on the course.
Yes, thank you. Multiple birdies, all birdies all the time.
And turkeys.
No, that's not a thing.
No, you've used to talk about the turkeys out there.
No, that's just they're walking around on the golf course. They're not, there's birdies, there's eagles.
I understand that.
Yeah,
Well,
all
maybe they
right.
like to play golf. I don't
And more like they're going to get hit in the head by a golf ball.
know. Okay.
Bye.